decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Okay, hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with Josh Firm from the Lotus Eaters. Some of you will, I'm sure, be familiar with him from that. Josh, would you like to introduce yourself and maybe even talk about the Lotus Eaters?
Sure. So, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me on. And a little bit late on a Sunday, but I'm surprised you're doing these back-to-back. I'd be knackered. But yeah, I've been at Lotus Eaters, which started about 4 years ago, and I was there right at the very beginning when Carl Benjamin set it up. But my background is I've got a master's degree in psychological research methodology, and so I came from sort of academia and went into this sort of company, and it was sort of framed as this, I suppose, alternative to the media in a sense. And that's sort of what we've slowly been growing towards. We've had these weird sorts of situations where I'll do like a segment about Japan or somewhere abroad, and it'll actually do the rounds in the host nation. And it's got to quite a point of success now. I'm very happy with how it's gone. But yes, I imagine people probably see me on Twitter. I go on there far too much as well. But yeah, I had a show on the Lotus Eaters website for 3 years, where that's where I think all my best work probably is. But I tend to focus more on, you know, psychological stuff because that is my background.
All right. You said that you'd like to talk about the current state of the political parties in Britain. This is something that I went into with my previous guest, Gregory Lauder-Frost, but obviously you're going to have your own perspective on it. And mm-hmm. I think you're more au fait with the detail of each political party as it is right now. Let's start with something ridiculous like the Green Party. What would you say about the Green Party as it is today?
They're a very entertaining vehicle to push LGBT propaganda down Muslims' throats. I think that that's one good thing, sort of stirring the pot a little bit, causing a bit of chaos. But no, yeah, it's interesting, really. One of the things, actually interesting things I've observed about the Green Party, other than, of course, they're all insane, is that it seems to draw very posh people, which sort of putting my psychologist cap on here, the fact that they're going so far left sort of says something to me. It sort of epitomizes British politics in a way, in that actually, particularly now, we're seeing a sort of state of play where the working classes tend to be more right-wing than middle or even the upper classes. And I think we're actually seeing a slight shift in this. I've been paying attention to people's sort of voting intentions and this sort of thing. And we're slowly seeing a separation. Of course, you see separations demographically, particularly recently, where people are showing these graphs where men and women are massively deviating, where everywhere except Britain, coincidentally, men are becoming more conservative and women are becoming more liberal. As you know, they're not necessarily conservative and liberal, but it's just the opposite ends of an axis. That's how they measure it. And so there's obviously some sort of interesting shifting going on. And that's one interesting thing that you can actually gather from that party, at the very least.
Yeah, I actually happened upon a graph just today. I might have seen it before now, but I saw it today and I decided to save it into my meme folder. And it is a very interesting shift that's going on there between men and women, but we'll go into that in a bit later. But what would you say about the Liberal Democrat Party?
Well, I think that they're sort of very open in not taking themselves seriously now. You've seen Ed Davey doing all of these publicity stunts. I can't think of a single policy, you know, I can't think of any of his flagship policies, any of his proposals. It's just sort of, we're the party that can coast because we're not the Tories or Labour, and therefore just in a very impoverished electoral situation, we can hoover up votes just by being a default party. And I think what their strategy is they're trying to be very inoffensive and just get attention for non-political reasons, because they don't actually have to do anything. Just the absence of any compelling alternatives allows them to occupy a niche, I suppose.
Yeah, it's quite ridiculous, really, isn't it? That they don't even pretend to have any policies, or if they do, they keep them completely under wraps and instead approach the public by way of these, as you say, stunts. Ed Davey dancing to some song. I mean, it's like he's a TikToker rather than a politician.
But then again,
TikTok as well.
We're going to see more of this in the future, because in some ways it's smart politics, and it's not necessarily what you want to see in a functional and moral political system. But at the same time, if the politicians are pursuing their own self-interest, as all politicians do, then it makes sense that they're not going to do anything that might otherwise jeopardize their reputation. Whereas, you know, these publicity stunts, at least it helps humanize them, because I think that one thing that I think is a good thing, but from the politician's perspective, it's a bad thing, is that there's never been a sort of lower degree of credibility of the political classes. And I think that this has got to erode completely. People have got to lose faith in the parliamentary system and in democracy functioning in Britain more generally for anything to improve. Because I think in many ways, the democratic system as it functions today is more of just a smokescreen for the way in which power actually works.
Yes, indeed. Where would you see the Conservative Party slotting into that? Because this is something that's of interest, a specific question that's of interest to me is, mm-hmm. when, at what point in history did the Conservative Party get corrupted, as it were, and stop serving the people of the country and instead serving big business, the banks, whatever you want to say?
Well, I think there's always been some degree of it within the Conservative Party, at least within the past 50 or 60 years. And then we're getting back into times where I've not looked in as great a detail. Many people point to David Cameron in 2010. I think a lot of it actually started with Thatcher, actually. A lot of what the Conservative Party became later on has its roots with her, and her glowing praise of Tony Blair and saying that he is the best part of her legacy. I mean, what more do you need?
Yeah, it's the separating of the party from actual convictions, and it just going into a completely pragmatic mode, like what will it take to win the next election, and what will it take to keep the economy going, or to keep the status quo going. So then how would you describe the Conservative Party today? Because it obviously has, it got a real beating in the general election when what was that, July? I've already forgotten mm-hmm. when that was.
4th of July, wasn't it?
Right, yes, that's right. And they've elected Kemi Badenoch as their leader.
My preferred candidate, to be fair.
Sorry?
My preferred candidate.
Oh, of course. So you were part of the zero seats, were you?
Yeah, well, I think that you've got to have a very strong view on the Conservatives after the treachery that they have basically allowed to unfold upon the British populace, that I think in many ways I still despise them more than even the Labour Party, because, you know, I'm certainly no fan of the Labour Party, that much is clear, but there's something about basically being controlled opposition and preventing any organic response to basically driving at the speed limit for Labour's policies. You know, they are just Labour with a blue rosette at the end of the day.
Yeah, at this point, it seems to be completely hollowed out. And I agree with you that Thatcher was a watershed there. But then, William Hague at the end of the 90s was a watershed. And then David Cameron. It was David Cameron who brought in gay marriage.
And he's very proud of that. He says whenever he's asked about which policy he's most happy about, what thing is he most happy about his time in office, which says a lot, doesn't it? Because, you know, a so-called conservative does something, you know, outflanking the left to the left. That's not something to be proud of necessarily.
Yeah, certainly. It's very strange. Especially when a huge percentage of the public would still oppose gay marriage, even now, I think, and certainly did in 2010. And then there was, oh God, how did it go? It was David Cameron. Then who came next? Boris Johnson. And then was Truss, and then Rishi Sunak. Or am I missing somebody? Oh, yeah, Theresa May.
That's right, yeah. Everyone forgets Theresa May every time.
I'm so sorry, Theresa.
Too busy hiding in those fields of wheat. That's what it is.
Well, I mean, that is a very, it's a very quick death spiral, it seems. I mean, would you say, like, it's now Kemi Badenoch. Would you say that the Conservative Party is on the way out? Or do you think it could rise again even yet?
Well, the way I look at British politics now is we've opened Pandora's box for racial identity. And I think that an increasing number of people won't vote for someone who isn't white British, particularly on the right-hand side of politics. And I think that that's a good thing because there are lots of things that make perfect sense if you start thinking like that. For example, you can look at Kemi Badenoch. It always seems weird to call her that. But you can look at her comments about how she has ethnic enemies in her home of Nigeria. Of course, she identifies with the Yoruba. This is none of the British people's business. Who cares? Unless we're going to take it over again, in which case, you know, maybe it's our business once more. But personally, I'm not interested.
And it underlines what people like I have been saying for years, that she is not us. I mean, we know nothing about the Yoruba. There will be some people who know about the history of that region of Africa, sure, but tiny number. And it just emphasizes that how much does she possibly have in common with us? How much can she really identify with us? I suspect very little. And it seems absurd to me that somebody like her has gone into the Conservative Party. I wouldn't be surprised if she was like Diane Abbott, David Lammy with Labour, because it makes sense. But to call herself a Conservative just seems ridiculous. And, of course, especially when she was part of the Conservative Party, when it was going for huge record-breaking numbers of migrants coming in every year.
Which she supported in 2018, didn't she? Quite vocally. And I think having someone like that with such a shaky record, which, funnily enough, Keir Starmer's already pointing out, which is good. He's obviously trying to flank to the right. He's learnt from Tony Blair that actually does work against the Conservatives. But spreading this sort of thing will unwittingly be his undoing, because it will make people realise that they can't trust the Conservatives, which will inevitably shift things rightwards, because the way things are running at the minute, it's the only way that things can go without things getting worse, because the trajectory that things like the economy, the political system, and people's engagement with politics is going, well, is certainly not sustainable, the current way that we're operating things. And so I see this shift as inevitable. Dare I say, you know, that the phrase that's become a bit of a meme now, that remigration is inevitable. Well, as far as I see, that's going to be the only thing that's going to make people satisfied now, because allow me to put it to you like this. So she moved here to Britain. She was born in Britain, but moved away. She came here at 16, and there's a sort of, there are multiple things that make the British, you know, or the English, the Scots, the Welsh, even the Northern Irish, perhaps, the way they are. And I think that you've got to be very much of a people. You've got to be grounded in a specific place, and it forms your identity. And of course, your genetics also predispose you. But your genetics, if you're rooted in a time and place, have been selected for thousands of years. And you can't really replace this. It's not like you can pluck someone from somewhere and drop them somewhere else, and all of a sudden, you know, they've got the same values. And I don't think someone, you know, from sub-Saharan Africa can ever be identical culturally to an ethnic British person. I simply don't see it as being possible, because they don't have the interplay between the land and the genetics that make up the people that they're meant to be representing.
Yeah, I certainly agree. Needless to say, someone's just pointed out that I forgot about Liz Truss when I was going through the leaders, and it's because there have been so many. So I think it's David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, and Kemi Badenoch. And that's all in the space of about 2016 to 8 years. That's quite amazing.
Well, it's great for me. I think it makes them look really weak, doesn't it? It makes them look indecisive
and chaotic. Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. So then finally, the party that is, you might say, is at the centre of social change in Britain over the last 100 years, Labour. We're obviously they've now got Keir Starmer. That's the government. What would you like to say about Labour, just as a summary?
Sure. Obviously, I'm not a big fan of them, but some sort of observations that I've made while trying to keep tabs on what they're up to, I suppose. Keir Starmer, I think, because he's so devoid of humanity, he's so unthinking and unfeeling, it makes him a very inflexible leader. And he's currently ruling the Labour Party like Joseph Stalin. And the Labour Party, of course, is forever known as being in perpetual states of infighting. And I think that because he's got this stranglehold over the party, I think at some point down the line, this is going to cause really big problems when people start losing faith in his leadership within his own party. And I think that there is going to be some sort of challenge to his power eventually down the line. However, he might be able to cling on until even the next election. So
I've just put him in this photo of him, which I always, he has an unfortunate tendency to look like a robot in photographs. Mm-hmm. And this is one example. It's not even the worst example, actually. I just happen to have it on file. But it's kind of illustrative of what I mean. He that could be a showroom dummy rather than a human being. It's quite notable.
Someone pointed out to me recently that they reminded him of one of the chickens from Chicken Run, you know, the Aardman animated thing, and I can't unsee it now.
I'll have to look out for that. I think the Labour Party, it sort of has a similar life cycle over the last 10 years as the wokery craze, which started as something sort of upbeat and psychedelic and silly and hippie-ish, freedom loving and so on. It's about the rights of people, the liberties. And then in 2020, it became authoritarian and dark with COVID. So then the rainbow flag gets associated with authoritarianism and a sort of grey dystopia. It's an interesting shift that happened there. And I think in the same way, you've got Labour the last 10 years being quite hippy-dippy. And then when they get into power, it's Keir Starmer, and who is very grey and lifeless and cold, and some have said psychopathic. I think it's, you've got to be careful throwing those words around, psychopath, narcissist, and so on. People throw them around like confetti nowadays. But anyway, the point is there clearly is something rather unusual about him. And so it's, and so you've got the Labour Party there, but it's a joyless Labour Party. And it's also a farcical, I mean, if you look at Angela Rayner, if you listen to Angela Rayner, it's kind of amazing that somebody like that is in government at all. And I think this also goes for Keir Starmer, though. I saw an interview with him and a Sky News reporter a few weeks ago. It was about nuclear war, of all things. And I remember thinking, just the way they spoke, their grammar, their diction, I thought it would have been absolutely unthinkable for the equivalent interview 50 years ago. The journalist, the reporter, would have been much more well-spoken and articulate, and so would the politician, the Prime Minister of Britain. Where now it feels like it was like 30 IQ points were missing on both sides. It's a frightening decline, really.
Well, I think that it's difficult to disentangle whether this is genuine stupidity or the sort of phenomenon that we had with the Tories, where people like David Cameron and George Osborne were getting de-elocution lessons, where they're actually deliberately going out of their way to seem less privileged, I suppose, in modern parlance. But it could just be that they're trying to appeal to the lowest common denominator, and so they're embodying that ethos. Or, I mean, it's very difficult to tell, because when people are behaving in that way, it's much harder to get a read on whether they're being genuine or not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it is. I remember hearing about this, and George Osborne as well, I think particularly needed a lot of de-elocution. And I mean, it's dreadful to think of such a thing, that we're going to make you less refined, less well-spoken, less posh.
Certainly it's antithetical to what I believe. I think that, if anything, it's an aspiration. I wish I could lose the sort of slight tinges of my West Country accent that make me say the start of the number three very strange. You know.
Oh, I see what you mean. I mean, I'm sympathetic to both sides in this, in the sense that I don't want all the regional accents of Britain to be lost. I don't want everyone to speak RP, mm-hmm. But I do love that some people speak RP. And when they speak RP, it should be good RP. It shouldn't be estuary English. You know, it shouldn't be that slanted mix of Cockney and RP. It's just, why would you do that? It started with Tony Blair. I do remember George Osborne and David Cameron, as you say, de-elocution. And also there was a decision that David Cameron must never be photographed in front of books. And in front of like bookshelves, because it made him seem, it was a thing. I remember it very vividly. It was a decision that his PR team made in order to make him more relatable to, you know, the common man, who I guess they assume just doesn't read books. But even if that's true, I think the common man would rather that his prime minister did read books. And if the common man doesn't want his leaders to be better than him, then he's a moron.
This is one of the sort of myths of democratic politics, isn't it? That you've got to have people that resemble you in every single which way. You know, obviously we've sort of been bludgeoned with it, with the notion of we need representatives for all of our different client groups within the country. But also it sort of crept in some ways to the right as well, in that we think that someone has to be of the same background or things like that. I mean, I'm certainly no aristocrat or anything like that. If an aristocrat came along and they said the right things and had the right ideas, and I believed that they were honest about their convictions, then I would have no qualms about supporting them. And I think that lots of people actually feel the same. And part of the reason that I think before Boris sort of stabbed the country in the back, what he represented was an eccentric aristocrat, and people liked that, and people warmed up to it. And they're subscribing to this false idea that you need to create someone who is like the people they're representing, when actually you don't. And in fact, people quite like it if they're not like that. People want to be led by people who seem exceptional.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I guess that gets us quite swimmingly to that graph that I was going to bring up. So here it is now, because I'd like your perspective on what the hell is going on here.
So this was the one I was talking about. That's the one I actually had in mind. And there's a lot to be said here. So South Korea, I think, is particularly unique because most of the men do military service, don't they? And also they've got a culture that is very, their sort of exposure to modern Western politics in many ways is just the feminist aspect of it. And so they've been radicalized in much the same trajectory, but to far greater extremes, because of course they've got a very real enemy on their north border, and the men are the ones getting conscripted, and the women are also simultaneously making a fuss. And so I think what has happened here is that the men are saying, well, actually, we're serving our traditional role of protecting, and you're not holding up your end of the bargain here. And so that's why we're seeing the men radically swerve to the right, whereas in the US and Germany, you're seeing sort of comparable trends there. And I think Germany, you're seeing those trends simply because the threat to the average German from the foreign populace that they've imported is so great that the natural inclinations of the male population are sort of kicking in, this perception of threat. And I think the same must go for the US as well, because of course, not only do they have very serious problems with the cartels down south, but also all the drugs that they import, guns and things like that. Yeah, I think we forget sometimes just how much crime goes on in the US. And then in the UK, of course, this is the most sorry graph of them all. Apparently the men are still very effeminate. And I think it is fundamentally, at least in my opinion, that it's the unwillingness to offend that's holding us back in the UK, if this data is to be believed. Because the men who are pushing back in Britain tend to be of a specific disposition. I think that they're far more likely to speak their mind when not well received, I suppose, more disagreeable by disposition, perhaps. And I was actually quite struck by just the sheer number of people on the right that are on the... It's going to sound derogatory, and I don't mean it to be, but they're on the autism spectrum. But that's interesting in and of itself, because, of course, that comes with at least an inability in some extreme cases, but a lesser inclination to conforming to social expectations.
So and also a reliance on logic and analysis. I mean, it's like mm-hmm. we've got 10,000 groks. You know, they're all reaching the objective conclusion that if our countries don't go right wing, they're going to go, they're going to head towards oblivion.
I think it's much easier to look at data with a sort of impartial eye and be indifferent. And it's something that I sort of had to learn through my education to have to do, and the value of, I suppose, because I'm not necessarily that way inclined, but it can be enculturated and habituated into people, which is at least a positive. So if people are taught the value of it, it's something that can be adopted and is not fated to happen, even though there's a dispositional element that is largely genetically programmed, at least to my understanding.
See, one thing I would say about, if we look at the US and Germany here, it's not just that the men are going right wing, it's that the women are going sharply left wing. That's the
I think that,
but while the men react to danger by getting defensive and turning right wing, the women react to danger by becoming even more open to it.
So I've got a bit of a question for you. This is something that I've noticed quite a lot in my adult life. Have you ever been sort of walking with a woman at night and perhaps there's a sort of shady figure walking towards you, or you sort of have an immediate read of the man's body language? And I've noticed that women's ability to perceive threat seems to be different to that of a man. For a man, it's almost instinctual. We can look at their body language and immediately know that whether they're going to be violent or not, or at least identify that we need to keep our attention on that person until there's an explicit sign. And I feel like this simply doesn't exist biologically in women. And I think that this is reflected in a multitude of various studies in how violent threats are perceived. And it's even to the point whereby our visual perception is different. When you're looking at facial perception, for example, men pay far more attention to angry faces than any other emotion, whereas women, there's a larger degree of variability. And research like that seems to indicate that actually these differences are quite stark. And I think that there's an element of that identifying the threat. But also, I think that we mustn't discount the notion of, there's been lots of push for feminism, that sort of thing, right? And these are parallel reactions to each other. Perhaps a downward spiral, perhaps not, is difficult to tell. But I think that people are bouncing off of one another in a similar way to how the Republicans and Democrats have polarized in the United States. Men and women have polarized as well, because my sort of reading of how it all plugs in together is that it's useful to fracture society, because, you know, as even Julius Caesar points out rather astutely, that, you know, you've got to divide and conquer, and you have more control over a population if they are further apart and there is less solidarity.
Well, absolutely, because of course a lot of men in this scenario that's illustrated there, a lot of men will realize that if they want to get anywhere with women, they're going to have to keep their political views quiet, or that's the conclusion they'll draw. I actually think that the opposite might often be true as well, that if you just unleash your power level, at least some women will be turned on, frankly, by that.
I mean, I can confirm that this is true. People will be amazed at how indifferent people are to politics if someone just likes who you are as a person. It doesn't really matter, actually. And it's one of those things that people are relenting. And also, there's, not to sort of lower the tone a little bit, but people quite often bring up the notion of, oh, you know, young people are never meeting people for relationships, but just have the strength of your own convictions to be able to speak your own mind. And also, if you're a man with controversial opinions, quite often women will go along with them once they're significantly invested in the relationship, I suppose. Not always. Yeah. It depends on the individual, of course. But
I've also heard about the opposite happening, where a young woman will realize that a guy is not sufficiently liberal, progressive, and so she'll end the relationship. It can go both ways. I mean, it is a sort of coin toss, I think, for a young guy to take that risk, because it really could drive her away, or it could pull her towards you. I don't know. It's something you'll just have to take the risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always like to frame it in an optimistic way of either it works out or you dodge a bullet. So I don't know why people are dragging their feet.
That's true. I mean, would you want to be with a girl who was just some insane liberal and there was no hope of her ever changing?
Well, it's not good for either party, really, is it?
No, indeed. It would also just be a pain in the arse to live with something like that. I just can't imagine it. I mean, what on earth? Would you just talk about music or TV or something? I don't know. It strikes me as that this is a very... The graph that was up there, I think that it is a very interesting situation. Someone pointed out that it's largely because of the expanding of university education. Indeed, it has the big rise in women being going left is in the last 20 years, especially in America. In Britain, it's over the last since 2010. I mean, that is an astonishing change in that decade, the 2010s. So I don't know. I'm not sure how much else there is to say about this. It just seems very significant, and it's going to have repercussions, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think the university certainly had some degree of influence, but I would be cautious to overstate it, because particularly in Britain, from my experience at least, the universities aren't nearly as far along, perhaps, as some of the American ones, where you get the most egregious examples. You know, you get one or two, but I still know people in academia, and they do their work perfectly ordinarily, as if none of this was happening. And I think that sometimes people have got to bear in mind that there's a bit of a selection bias in what people hear about it. Not that I've got any reason to defend it. I've got no involvement in academia these days, but just that it's not all bad, you know?
Yeah. Yes, of course. It's always possible to have a caricature notion of something in your head and in our sphere as well, our circles. So that's a very interesting thing. As I say, I think it's going to have repercussions. But other than that, what would you say about Britain's political situation now, post the general election? Do you see the Starmer learning from Blair and becoming less, you know, autistic, or do you see him doubling down? And where do you think the Conservative Party is going to go? And how do you think reform is going to impact all of this? Very open question.
So I was quite surprised that Keir Starmer so quickly started to pivot right, particularly when he started talking about the immigration data. And of course, you don't necessarily need to believe what he's saying, but it's interesting that he's trying to present himself in that way, because it suggests that he's seeing more of a threat from a potential coalition between the Conservatives and Reform, which I think the way things are going, I know Reform have tried to make out as if they're not going to go into coalition with the Conservatives, but I think it's likely, in which case they're going to enable much more of the same. And I think that Farage has not been the leader that people had hoped he is. And I've actually spoke to a fair few people that have been associated with him over the years, and sort of also following his career as it's gone on as well. I'm under the impression that this is truly what he believes. This isn't optics. This isn't him being very conscious or trying to be the Tories 2.0. This is genuinely his convictions. He's basically just another form of Conservative Party conservative, just not in the party.
Yeah, he's a 90s civic nationalist.
Exactly.
So then reform, would you say that that's a sort of damp squib, that it's not going to be much of a factor?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and it can go one of two ways. It can either go the way that I see most commonly, whereby people say, and I think that's a valid concern, that they're going to act as a form of controlled opposition, sort of limit what could happen in a rightward direction and sort of take the steam out of the sails of the rightward shift. And that's possible, and it would be a tragedy, because I think it would prevent us going all the way to correcting the problems in this country. However, it could also be the case that, as we've seen with Trump recently in America, by someone bringing this politics to the table and bringing it to the mainstream, it all of a sudden becomes normal, and then other things can then be brought to the table that wouldn't otherwise be. And, you know, them being the most viable rightward option at least could serve that purpose, even though I'm very, very hesitant to believe they're going to do anything good. it's just a sort of fool's hope, I suppose.
I do think that Rupert Lowe is based and has a lot of promise. I just see, the way it seems to me is that Nigel Farage needs to get out of the way at this point, because I think he's served his purpose, and as much he's done as much as he's going to do, and from this point on he's just going to be an obstacle to other people. Because, you know, what he said about, I'm sure you're aware of what he said about the Muslims, the bloc Muslim vote a few weeks ago, it implies to me that he's just given into this, he's resigned to this, that Britain is eventually going to be a majority Muslim country. And if so, then he's definitely not what we need, and also not, I think, what the general public want in an age when other countries are talking about mass deportation. And he said that that's simply impossible, simply not, it can't be done.
Yeah, and I think in that interview he was he framed it in the sense of, imagine what people will say about me. So he was trying to be slimy and getting out of saying it. And I think that was his motivation. But I do have very significant reservations about whether he can do anything positive. And I think actually he is more likely to do more bad than good. I think also parachuting in this Zaya Yusuf fella, I think after he donated, what was it, £200,000 to reform? So basically paying for commissions. I mean, it didn't work in the Crimean War, and it won't work for reform. And I think that the fact he's also a Muslim doesn't help, and that he says that you need to appeal to the Muslim vote. Well, that's the worst thing you can do, to alienate your own core base. Also not true electorally either. You don't need the Islamic vote to win an election in Britain at all.
And you'll never get them anyway.
That's no, of course not.
It's like the Republicans in America. You're never going to get the black vote.
They're going to vote to deport themselves and vote to take away their own housing and welfare. Yeah, I don't think so.
Don't gives me that. It's never going to happen. No, I agree. And I do think that this is something where somebody needs to just grasp this nettle, as Gregory Lauderfrost was saying. Somebody needs to get real on this and realize we don't need to pursue them. Let Labour have the Muslim vote. We need to appeal to our base, the British public, the native British public. This has always been the problem, getting a right-wing party not to cuck to the left, getting a right-wing party to actually pursue its base and not betray its base. I think it's been baked into them for a long time. They're not even trying. They're taking their base for granted, and they're definitely not trying to appeal to them. I mean, even Donald Trump, I don't think he ever referred to white America, I think it may be in veiled terms, but never explicitly. Whereas he was perfectly happy to talk about black Americans and all this, the black vote and so forth. I think it's seen as uncouth and just unsayable that you would acknowledge and try to court the white vote and the indigenous vote in the case of Europe.
Well, it's certainly more so the case in the United States, I think, that they've got, you know, sort of bound up in their founding mythology is this sense of civic nationalism. And although that's a little bit of a red herring and it need not be that way, people interpret it that way, even on the right, that, you know, as long as they've got American values, they can live here. I think that's personally a mistake. However, I think in Europe, we tend to approach things far more, I don't know whether this is a pre-existing term, but in a sort of ethno-realist way, we understand that people tend to side with their ethnicity more because there are more ethnicities sort of dotted around that Europe. And so there's there's a more obvious distinction, whereas this sort of melting pot ideal in the States makes the civic nationalist arguments a little bit easier to be accepted, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's not fair or accurate for a white American to say, I'm just white, like, I don't have a culture. That's a crazy thing to say. But it can, it obviously does persuade. It seems convincing to a lot of people. By contrast, a German could never say, well, I'm just German. There's nothing to me. That's a contradiction in terms. So we've always got that identity, that heritage to hark back to and to hold on to. Whereas I think that Americans have somehow been persuaded that they are sort of nothing, that they, I don't mean all of them, I just mean a lot of them, have been persuaded that to be white and American is basically just to be nothing. I think this is a terrible thing that's happened, and completely untrue as well.
The thing is, how could America pivot towards something more resembling a European rootedness? Because, of course, for most of Europe, there are thousands of years of traditions that have a linear continuity in most cases, or at least go through gradual stages in a way that's very organic. And in the United States, it doesn't necessarily have that. And I think people talking about it being a young country, I think that's still quite important. I think that there are very distinct ways in which each side of the Atlantic functions culturally. I think Europe tends to be, surprise, surprise, a bit more of the old world than the United States is. And therefore, I think it's easier for us to find what it means to be our respective ethnicities or nationalities because we're more proximate to it. When you're in the United States, you know, you can find out what your blood is, but you're so far removed from the culture that it's very difficult to return to such a thing. And also, it's a sort of simulacrum. It's inauthentic if you're trying to revive it. It sort of seems a bit like a LARP, which is also less than ideal. And so I don't really have any resounding answers here, but I imagine that many Americans will probably have thought about this in much greater detail than I have, and probably have addressed it in a much more robust way.
Yeah. It's something, I mean, the big Dave Martell was talking about this kind of thing last night. He is an American, and he was addressing this. I think it is a thing. But as you say, within the British context, there is, we don't have that problem, at least not nearly so much. I mean, I don't think I've heard anyone saying, well, I'm just British. I'm nothing. I'm not Afro-Saxon or Pakistani British or something.
Afro-Saxon.
It's a phrase I heard that was quite funny. So no one says that. I think everyone acknowledges to be British, whether it's English, Scottish, Welsh, or a mix thereof, is to be something. It's something very distinctive. No one pretends that it's just vanilla, that it's just default. We're not at that stage yet, and I don't actually think we're going to get to that stage, because I think long before then, this whole situation is going to be upended one way or another. But with that in mind, one thing you said that you'd like to talk about is, I'll get your wording correct, what policy, what we need to do to fix Britain, what policies need to be enacted, and that sort of thing. So that's of interest to me, because something I try to do with Millennial is to not have it just be a whine fest. I like the idea of constructive solutions. After all, Christmas is about renewal as much as anything else. So what would you say in the way of a way forward for Britain at this stage?
Well, there are multiple things, really. I mean, it's a massive question, isn't it?
It certainly is.
How do I fix the entire country?
You want to take England on its own, then that's fine.
Well, I think actually a lot of the problems are very similar between England, Scotland, and Wales. certainly economically. But I think the primary problem is that of immigration that needs to be solved first. And I've got very particular ideas of how to do that. I think that some of the actions of other continental European countries are misguided, like paying people money to leave. We do that with Albanian prisoners. We pay them, I think it's £1,500 to basically clear off and go back to Albania, because it's cheaper than keeping them in our prison. But of course, that also creates a financial incentive. And I think actually it's far better, if anything, to figure out how much these people have taken from our system and basically make them pay for their remigration plus the costs they've accrued based on their assets. So when we deport them, we also make sure that they haven't raided the coffers of the country before sending them on their way. And if people realize, okay, if I break into Britain, I'm going to have to pay for my own deportation, plus, you know, any welfare I've taken out the system, any, you know, you tally up all the costs before sending them on their way, that is a much stronger disincentive to come here. And I think that you need only basically say, if you're not contributing economically, you know, you've been on welfare for X amount of time. There are lots of different criteria. You don't even need to necessarily say, okay, you know what, I've had enough of everyone from Pakistan. They all need to go. You don't need, because I think that would be a tough sell to the British public as well, as much as I think it would be beneficial. You can just simply set economic criteria, and they are not going to meet these thresholds relative to the native population, because the same thing that's making them economically counterproductive is the same thing that's causing all the cultural problems. And it's that they're not Europeans and not capable of living in the same way that we do. And so that's certainly how I'd approach immigration. And I think that you can easily do that. I think if you explain the criteria and say, okay, well, if someone's not contributing to the country, we send them home. That's an easy sell to the British public. It's just like, well, do you want to pay more tax or not? And I think with a lot of other things, particularly the economy, you've just got to preserve industry. One thing I've noticed looking at numbers across the country and looking at the cities that do well and not, is that if industry is about 8 to 15% or more of your economy, you have a relatively healthy economy in that city. And it's not always true. There are other markers as well. But I think we've got to remember that there are still lots of people that need forms of employment. And there are lots of things that I think we can justify keeping in Britain. I know the economics make sense to import some things, but when it's food or steel, things that have come back to bite us before, you know, our inability to supply our own food was what allowed the Americans to leverage their own influence and break up the British Empire. And we shouldn't be making those same mistakes. We should be growing our own food. We should be protecting industries that are of national significance and national security significance. And I think also we should be spending a lot more on the military, even though I'm not an interventionist. I don't think we should be going out, but I think that it simply provides much more bargaining power on the international stage, because one thing that we do have is a good special forces, aircraft carriers, things that are a very hard power. We can lean into that and at least have a certain degree of influence, and that would help, I think. What do you reckon? Obviously, there's a lot more, so just for the sake of being concise, I'll leave it there.
I think it's very... I'm surprised by what you say about making them pay for their own remigration. I think that's it's obviously a very amusing idea. I actually do think that a lot of the British public would approve of that, because I think that the British, I don't think there's much difference here between the English and the Scots or the Welsh. I think that the British have a very moral sense of right and wrong, and they don't like doldossers. They don't like parasites. They don't like scroungers. layabouts. These are all terms that are well known in Britain because there's such a strong feeling against this. So I think that would be a good way to justify, rationalize the deportation of huge numbers of people, to say, well, they're not contributing economically. And at this point, that, I mean, common sense would have told anyone that years ago. But at this point, I think there are academic studies that have been conducted that have reached this conclusion.
The government's own data suggests it, yeah.
Yeah, actually, there was just today I saw that there was a professor at Sheffield Hallam University who got, or lecturer or something, a researcher, who got, the university is disavowing him because he did a study that reached this conclusion that mass immigration is not good for the economy. And of course, I mean, how could it possibly be when it, given the types of people, the types of cultures that they're coming from, what are the odds that they are going to be more economically productive than the Northwestern Europeans? It's a ridiculous claim to make. And I think you don't even, race doesn't even have to come into it. It's just the cultures that they're coming from. They're obviously not going to be operating at our level. So, and I think a lot of people realize this, and a lot of people lament that we are clearly spending a fortune. And this is without even going into the refugee hotels, which is a whole thing in itself. And even without that, we are clearly spending a fortune shepherding, looking after people who can't and almost certainly won't ever fit into our society. So I think a lot of people see this not in terms of racial identity or whatever, but just in terms of injustice. They're thinking, why am I paying for this person who is in prison after living on the dole, after dealing drugs, after being violent to his girlfriend, after creating 5 illegitimate children? I mean, it's just crazy to do that to a society, to inject into its populace a huge number of people who behave that way and expect the natives to be okay with it. Yeah, that no wonder they have so many lies, because about mass immigration and diversity as our strength and all this, they have to keep repeating these mantras because the truth is so obviously the opposite.
Well, it's interesting to me that they're trying to sort of sell this almost big society lie to people that this can function, when in many ways Britain, one thing that unites all of the nations that make up the United Kingdom is a more parochial approach traditionally to living. You know, it's more about localism, it's more perhaps agrarian in culture than other European countries. And normally this would be a much tougher sell to people, that they're now going to be supporting people not only outside of their own community, but outside of their own ethnicity, that have only recently come to the country. This is something that is antithetical to the character of all of Britain, if people were being completely honest with themselves. And I think that you can see this. Recently, we were actually at Lodestar, we covered James O'Brien and read some of his books. And it's funny how even in someone like him, he has this little English right winger in the back of his head that he's got to silence and go out of his way. I think he ended up getting therapy in the end, which is funny. But there's always this sort of ghost of traditionalism looming over even very left-wing people in Britain, because it's draped over all of the sort of cultural artifacts that still remain from our greater days of the 19th century.
Yeah, I was just looking for a meme about James O'Brien, but I can't find it, so I'll leave it for now. But I am interested in this, what you say, this ghost of English identity that's there in him. Can you Can you talk a bit about that? Because I haven't read his books, so I don't know.
Yeah, so I think that in many things that are not controversial to left-wing thought, there is traditionalism and British identitarianism smuggled in through the back door. Like, if you enjoy history in any capacity, there's going to be some degree of this smuggled in, because, you know, you look at some of the old religious sites like Stonehenge, for example. To value that, you've got to value the continuity of your ancestors and the value of preserving things which dispositionally are not particularly left-wing traits. And so it in some domains moves people outside of their otherwise default political frame of reference. And I suppose what it would mean would be that you can potentially, if you appeal to these things, you can drag people rightwards because the architecture's already there. The appreciation for good manners, of being considerate of, you know, that I'm always surprised to see people, you know, under 30 who still, when they get a phone call on the train, go into the lobby and take it there so it doesn't disturb other passengers, of not answering the phone on a bus. Or it's this sort of what used to be the default level of civility still survives on in some capacity, even amongst people who don't necessarily consciously recognize the importance in preserving it. It's just habituated. And I think habituation and an appreciation for continuity are still aspects of the British identity that linger on no matter what your politics are. And therefore, if people approach their rhetoric in a sort of very precise and insightful way, you can appeal to this and win people around in ways that you might not expect, which I've personally had experience with people in my life that I didn't think would end up agreeing with me about stuff.
It is an interesting possibility, because a lot of liberals, you see, part of our exasperation with progressives is that they don't seem to realize that the things they value rely on Europeans, you know, rely on there being a predominance of Europeans in that society. Otherwise, you won't have the recycling. You won't have the nice surroundings. You won't have the garbage collection. You won't have the clean water. You won't have the assumption of innocence. You won't have the civility. You won't have the manners.
Unless you won't have a functioning society.
No, indeed. You won't have the gentle nostalgia. Like, if you think about something like hauntology, that's the example that's in my head because I saw this quite recently. It's a bunch of people who are nostalgic about Britain. Like, to put it very crudely, they're nostalgic about Britain in the 70s and nostalgic about Victorian and Edwardian Britain. It's a sort of an aesthetic that encompasses those things. Well, those things were white. Those things were native English. You can't transplant an Indian or a black person into that without it being absurd, without it being a parody of itself. And also, you can't assume that other people that from other backgrounds are going to value this thing, because they don't have any connection to Britain of the 70s or Britain of the Edwardian era or whatever. Whereas for you and me, our parents were there in the 70s. They remember it. They told us about it. They mentioned things about it. We saw photos from then. We saw wallpapers from then, perhaps. I think I did. Maybe not you.
Even the 60s, to be fair.
So it's something that's recognizable to us. Victorian Britain, I'm sure when I was a child, I'm sure when you were as well, and still now, there are these echoes of Victorian Britain which arrive into our lives uninterrupted by any sense violation because it was our people. So it's not, there's no ethnic divide being crossed there. There's a clear line from us to the Victorians. And so it's not offensive. But to newcomers, it is offensive because they know that wasn't theirs. There is no clear line between them today and it. So its existence and it being remembered even only reminds them that they don't really fit in here, that this isn't really their home, certainly not as much as it is our home. And so it's annoying that liberals, who are often very nostalgic, that maybe not quite as nostalgic as some of us, but I don't know, maybe even more so, frankly, that they're very tied to things that are very British, very English, very Scottish, whatever. It's so annoying that they can't see this all depends on us. You might have an Indian friend, and he might listen and humor you while you talk about this thing, 18th century politics, 19th century design, whatever. He might listen and smile, but he really doesn't connect with it at all. Why can't you realize that? Because once he's in the majority, all of this stuff is just going to fall by the wayside. It clearly is, because they've got no reason to care about it.
Well, I think that what goes on here is that there's got to be some inability to recognize group, because, of course, there are the studies that suggest that left-wingers tend to either not have a very strong in-group preference or actively have an out-group preference. So that indicates to me that they don't perceive groups in the same way that you or I might. And there's also the addition of the fact that people use people's faces, basically their physiognomy as well as their manner of dress, as a proxy for their values. And this is proven to be statistically significant as well. People can predict this and be right. I mean, it's to the point whereby people have an above chance of even guessing someone's name correctly because of the association between specific names and faces. And so ignoring this fact that you can make judgments about people's character based on how they look and how they present themselves, I think that's one fundamental pillar of it. But there's also an aspect of it whereby they don't necessarily identify with their own in-group, and therefore they fail to recognize when it's contingent on that. And I think that having grown up in an area which was 100% ethnic British, one of the things that you very quickly realize is that the reason this high trust society exists is because you can look at that person and you know what they believe just by looking at them. You don't need to necessarily sit down and interrogate them for a few hours about their deepest held principles. You know, because they're like you to a certain degree, and you get a rough approximation. And of course, there are ethnic British people that I feel like are not like me, but I can tell that by looking at them. And it sounds very simple. It sounds almost laughably basic, but it's one of those things that clearly people are overlooking. And I find this notion in the modern day of not judging people or being judgmental as being a bad thing. And I always remind people that no, actually judging is upholding moral standards. If you don't judge people, you have no standards to uphold. And therefore, you know, you're no good to anyone. And when you put it like that, it makes it sound a little bit more compelling, perhaps.
Well, the funny thing is that the word discriminate used to be a good word. It used to be thought of positively, that it's a good thing to do. If you can't discriminate, then you're a retard. You know, you've got no you've got no sense of things. But that's obviously been very much demonized. Yes, I agree with you. I think it's very interesting how much you can, as you say, the way someone dresses, the way they conduct themselves. Yes, you can tell pretty much everything you need to know from them based on that. It is actually well, that.
You can even tell what music they listen to, probably how they vote. And you can even do this. I've seen research where people can look at a composite of someone's face and guess how they vote politically. Just the outline of their face and nothing else above chance rates. And so that suggests an entirely genetic understanding of this thing. And of course, genetics determine both people's personality, obviously their appearance, but their personality to a significant degree, that's heritable. And of course, personality informs politics. And so it makes sense that there's this continuity there. And of course, the same genes that determine people's personality also determine how they look. So you can look at, say, the domestication of the fox in Russia. So they tried to select for just non-aggression. That was the only behavior they were selecting for. And the fox changed in all sorts of different ways. Its tail changed, its ears became droopy, the coarseness of its fur changed, its physical appearance changed entirely after selecting for just one behavioral trait. And that seems to me to be a pretty compelling suggestion that there is a very genetic sort of cause for our ability to look at people and be able to make these snap judgments. Because you can look at someone and think they have a trustworthy face, they look violent, they look like trouble, and it is going to be backed up by something because you're basically programmed and it manifests in the unconscious mind that you recognize these patterns because you can't consciously deal with the massive sums of data you would get of all of the faces you've seen and all of the records, but it can be processed in a feeling, a sort of vibe, if you will.
Absolutely. And this is something that I've wanted to, that it occurs to me that basically your gut instinct is correct 9 times out of 10. What would you say to that? Because I've realized that I really should trust my gut instinct about people. It occurred to me a few years ago that actually every time I had a bad feeling about someone, they did turn out. I didn't know. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know what it was. I felt guilty for thinking this about them. But every time they did turn out to be a piece of shit. So I could have saved myself quite a bit of trouble by just trusting that instinct in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that what happens is that your unconscious mind collects all of these various data points and adds them all up in the form of a feeling. And so you're innately programmed to make these judgments because being very sociable animals, human beings, our survival is very contingent on our ability to judge the intentions of those who live amongst us. And to do so accurately would be a very obvious advantage because, of course, it means you're less likely to die and more likely to exist and have children and therefore spread your genes. And that's why I think this has been selected for. And I think that people forget just how powerful this is. And I think that there are situations where trusting your gut isn't necessarily good. I know there's quite the famous book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which looks at human decision making. And that happens to be my specialization, actually. It's what I did my master's dissertation on. And there are many circumstances where actually trusting, you know, going with your gut may run into sort of fallacies of thinking because it's quick and instinctual rather than long and deliberate. And it actually uses different neural networks in the brain. So if you're making quite a significant, important decision, it actually makes sense to stop and think through it methodically. Whereas sometimes trusting your gut is the right thing to do. And I think one of the difficult parts of, you know, being a human being is knowing when to listen to either or.
That's a good point. It is. Because there is no manual for this. There's no textbook telling you, in this situation, trust your gut. In this situation, think it through. So, yeah, it can be quite dodgy. Okay, well, let's go to some super chats because there were quite a few. Okay, Mr. Webster said, I, as a 26-year-old Englishman, don't see the UK stabilising as a nation when you have a dwindling police force and increasing dangerous imported third world people who will cause UK cities to destabilise. Is the Britain's destiny the transforming, like what happened in the Kosovo war?
I think that we're far too conscious as a people to allow our total replacement. I think that there are too many people who are too aware of what's going on for this to go on inevitably. And maybe I'm just naive and optimistic, and maybe I'm just too invested in the fight, so to speak. You know, it's one of those things where I know I'll never live outside of Britain, and therefore I don't want to see the place I know and love fall. Maybe that's clouding my judgment. But at the same time, I think that we've got to give ourselves some credit and have a little bit of faith in our national character, and what makes our country great is the people. And it's not like the people have disappeared necessarily, and there are many wonderful people that could turn this country around in a heartbeat. We've got no lack of potential. It's just about getting the right opportunity to do so. But then again, I could be completely wrong. Maybe I'm just naive, but one can hope.
Optimistic. Yeah, well, I agree with you, and it's for the same reason that I simply need this to be the truth. Therefore, I believe that it is the truth, because otherwise I would despair. So it's kind of like fake it till you make it, I suppose. I can't imagine living anywhere else. I mean, I have done it in the past, but I don't want to do it in the future, and I certainly don't want to die anywhere else. I want to live out my life in the place where I belong. So I need to believe it's possible to do that. And yeah, I don't want Britain to die. I don't want it to become a foreign country. I remain hopeful that it can be saved. The Woodlander, hello Woodlander, says, Josh, you often talk about land. I don't know if you're familiar with the Woodlander, but he has a project, the Woodlander Initiative, to buy up land. It's very much his thing. And he will be appearing on Millennial later on. Josh, you often talk about land. Do you believe that there is an intrinsic bond between a Britain and our land? Would you agree that large towns and cities separate us from how we should be living in touch with nature?
I've covered this in great detail at Load Seaters, actually, and I've in one episode of my series actually entertained the question, well, is it just the city environment that has caused a lot of the problems that we've got? And I know that sounds a little bit heretical at first, but you then look at things like if population density maps quite nicely onto crime rates, for example. And it also maps quite nicely onto rates of mental illness as well. And so it seems to me that human beings are not programmed to live so densely. And as someone who is not used to, say, the hustle and bustle of London, sort of by the end of spending a day there, it feels like you're exhausted because, you know, being in contact with that many people is not biologically normal. You know, you're fight or flight response must be going off multiple times, and it's draining for the body. And you notice in a big city, for example, that everyone has the glazed over eye look, everyone is miserable, and you go out to the countryside, everyone is happier. And I know that's a very general statement, but I think it's true in pretty much every country on planet Earth. And I think that it's one of those aspects of human nature that is so hard grained into us that we'll soon look back at living in, you know, flats, which I'm ironically living in right now, but as something that's almost inhumane and separates us from our nature in a way that is deeply harmful. And I think if we were rooted in a more natural place in terms of being in a rural area, it feels much more, I can't really put a word on it, perhaps. You feel like you're in the right place and time for the moment in a way that you don't really feel like you are in a city.
Yeah, I wouldn't add anything to that because I just agree with you. I think that, well I will add something. I think that we are evolved for small communities, a village. We're evolved to be in close proximity to the land. I think that the more we don't, the more distance there is, the more we are opened up to abstract ways of see it, like not knowing the connection between the seasons and growth, not knowing the connection between growth and supply shortages or abundance, this kind of thing. I don't think it's good for us. I think it ends up being a very artificial way of living and a very artificial and delusional way of seeing the world. I've seen it said that the children of farmers are some of the most, are often very realistic people, very honest people, very sensible people, because they have such an intense perception of this. They've been raised to see the ways of nature, the rhythms of nature, the ways that things happen and don't happen. And I can believe that. I definitely believe that. I also think at a different level that the natural environment simply has a different effect on us from the artificial built environment. It's one thing to like these aesthetics, like in a film or something, but to actually live in them is a different thing. That's all I would say there.
I also think that after, Britain's been inhabited over 10,000 years, and I think that if you've got ancestral roots that go back thousands of years, your genes have been shaped to exist in this environment. I've traced my family history, and I've basically got Brittonic, that's like 96%, and I've got like 1% Norwegian, 2% German, which is very low for, the Anglo-Saxon, but it's I've got Scottish on one side and Devonshire on the other, so it's sort of opposite poles of the British world. And so I think it shapes where you live. Like I feel very much rooted in Devonshire, where I grew up, because it has a very different feel than the rest of southern England. And I think that you've got to exist in a specific time and place. And I think that it was the normal thing to do to stay in the sort of territory in which you existed. I mean, it's the same even with packs of wolves. And ever so quickly, I know I've been going on about this quite a long time, there's such a number known as Dunbar's number, which is based on psychological research, that the number of people we can name and recognize is 500. And the people we can keep a sort of not so close acquaintance with is about 150. And we can keep stable relationships with about 50 people. And so that can tell us pretty much biologically what we're set up to deal with. Anything over 500 people, and we're already veering into territory where we're not biologically programmed to deal with a society of that scale. And you might well run into problems, although, of course, we're quite adaptable animals.
Yeah, well, that's the whole mystery, isn't it? How adaptable are we? And then that gives license to progressivism and transhumanism and so on, to find out, well, what are the limits? How far can we push ourselves away from the default and the natural and so forth? So it's a very big question, but I think, that's probably going to be played out in this century, I think, that question. Okay, Darby said, half of Reform and Conservative MPs voted in favour of the assisted suicide legislation. That was such a black pill for me. Clear them out. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, Josh?
I was quite surprised at how it divided political parties sort of down the middle in some senses. It's one of those things as well that I don't know how I feel about it necessarily, in that, on the one hand, if someone's got like a terminal illness and it's worse to live with it than to die. I think it should be their choice. But then at the same time, I don't necessarily trust this government to be the one that defines the exception. You know, I know that if I had something like Alzheimer's or dementia, which my grandparents had, and it's horrible, I would not want to live with that past a certain point. And so, but at the same time as well, I do worry that it would go the way of Canada and start euthanizing people for mental health reasons, which I believe are reversible. And so it's one of those things. But then this is one of those things that's similar to abortion. And this might make people very upset with me, but the kinds of people who you would want not doing it tend not to do it. And with all sorts of various things like this, there is a certain effect on society that some could argue might be desirable, in that leftists take themselves out of the society one way or another via not having children or euthanizing themselves. And
bloody hell. Yeah, I remember hearing someone saying once that they were talking about a government proposal to pay, to offer $1,000, it was in America, $1,000 to get sterilized. And he said, it's a good idea because the kind of people who would take $1,000 to get sterilized are exactly the people you would want to get sterilized.
I mean, it's my kind of dystopia, let's just say that. we can select for quality people by offering low-hanging fruit for low-quality people, then wonderful. But I don't think most people share my views on that. And I'll probably get a lot of flack, but I can't help but be inclined that way.
No, I understand.
I'm not the most sympathetic of person, let's just say that.
No, I agree with you. And also on the assisted dying thing, I've got an essay, because that's a lot to say there. I won't go into it, but I'll just say that I do think there needs... I think our ancestors probably had some way of dealing with this, that person is beyond hope. They've got no quality of life. They're miserable. They're in pain, physical pain. We'll spend a night with them in a cold barn, and in the morning they'll have gone. I can imagine. I don't know that happened, but I suspect that it did, because otherwise, I just don't know how this was dealt with in the past. But I think
are the cases in sort of Viking societies where the elderly, supposedly ended their own lives in a sort of honorable way. I don't know how true that is. It's one of those things where I've not really looked into it, but there must be equivalents.
Yeah, exactly. There must be. So it's not something that's new to our time and the age of, you know, those pods that you go into and they kill you, they fill you with gas and all that, which I do find very disturbing and soulless and cruel, well, cold. So I'm completely with the majority of our sphere on that. But at the same time, I think realistically, there should be some way, because life does, especially now, because medicine keeps us alive long enough to get dementia and for it to advance. So life does get into these hopeless situations. And I think you wouldn't keep an animal. You would be punished by the law for keeping an animal alive in that condition. So I do think I don't have any hard and fast opinions about this. I just think I'm more sympathetic to it, especially because I've seen dementia with three of my relatives, and I don't want to go through it myself. So it's something that's on my mind. I think that. I just think it's not something where it's not helpful to see it in black and white. Put it that way.
I think one thing that might make people feel a little bit better about it is that if it's one of your loved ones, presumably they would listen to what you have to say, and if you had a particularly strong opinions on it, I would imagine that they would listen to you by merit of them, you know, being a loved relative. And I would like to think that, you know, if one of my family members wanted to go through with this and I thought it was the wrong thing to do, they would listen to me and I could talk them out of it and make them see reason. And I suppose that's not a position that most people want to be in, but at the same time, it's something to bear in mind, I guess.
Yeah. One other aspect to this is, and I think you touched on it, is obviously I don't like the people who are pushing this. I don't trust the government. I don't like the idea of people profiting from this. I think that's sick. I don't generally trust the governments at all of the, around the West. So the idea of them having a way to induce people to kill themselves, I wouldn't trust that. And indeed, in the case of Canada, immediately it's gone from extreme cases, rare and all that, to, well, you know, people make jokes about this. Well, you've broken your leg. Would you like euthanasia? This sort of thing. But it's not that far off. I think it was in the Netherlands, there was a girl who was like 25 and she had depression and she elected euthanasia. And that is completely ridiculous. And it annoys me that it so quickly goes to that from a reasonable, you know, safe, legal and rare kind of thing, which is just humane and understandable and probably fits into our ancestral traditions. It goes from that instantly to let's cull the population using any excuse we can find. And that's just exactly like with abortion. Exactly. So yeah, that's annoying, but it's a very contentious topic in our sphere because people understandable for the moral reason, but also because they simply don't trust the government. They don't want the government having this tool. And I totally understand why. I agree with them. Okay, I think those are all the super chats. Hold on a second. The Enrieb said, have you ever heard of an ant death spiral? There are videos on YouTube. It's where ants get stuck following a circular pheromone trail that results in the death of all the ants on that path. Is it a bad thing that these ants die? Is the ant colony stronger after all the retarded ants have died? I don't know how this relates to what we've been saying. That was posted 35 minutes ago, so I'm not quite sure what we were saying at the time.
Well, I happen to know about this, actually, and it's more so that it's a glitch in how ants function. Obviously, they've basically got nothing that really resembles a brain. It's just sort of programming. But it happens too few of a time not to be significant enough for the species to go extinct. And it might damage the specific ant colony to a significant degree, but they're also ants, and so they can propagate pretty quickly. And so these behaviors that otherwise harmful to survival are still not harmful enough to cross the threshold to push them into, say, extinction.
All right. And then the NREB also said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I think that was Philip K. Dick or Isaac Asimov. I can't remember which. Oh, maybe Arthur C. Clarke, actually. And he says, when an immigrant drops rubbish on the ground, it is picked up by magic. When a white person talks quietly on a phone, it's magic. Well, perhaps. And this relates to the cargo cult thing as well, of the appearance of something being the thing. And yeah, but they do think differently from us. Let's just leave it at that. Okay, I think that's probably time to wrap up. It's been an interesting conversation.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be all about politics, but I wanted it to be about psychology. And I do think we touched on that quite a lot, so I'm glad. Is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
Well, once again, thank you very much for having me on the show. And also, I hope both yourself and everyone watching at home has a lovely Christmas. Hope you go and see your family. Reach out to some friends you haven't seen. I always say this at Christmas time. One of these days, I'll get someone a nice story saying how I reconnected with someone over Christmas. It's important, this stuff, you know, it's part of the informal tradition of Christmas to do these sorts of things. And also have a good new year and, you know, keep on with a good fight, I suppose.
Right, excellent. Well, I'll be back in about 10 minutes with the MW Public mod team. That should be interesting. But in the meantime, Josh Firm, thank you for taking part in Millennial X.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. I'll see you all soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.